Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in to our internet radio broadcast. RedEyesCreations.com is the website, and today we have an interesting program ahead of us. We are going to talk about the electric universe and plasma mythology with our guest Rens van der Sluis. He is the author of two books, The Mythology of the World Axis, Exploring the Role of Plasma in Mythology, in World Mythology, and also The World Axis as an Atmospheric Phenomenon. He is also behind the website mythopedia.info, and he regularly contributes articles to thunderbolts.info that focus on the electric universe theory. And Rens' research looks at what I myself consider to be one of the most interesting aspects to the electric universe theory, and that is the so-called plasma mythology idea. And as I said, that is what we're going to explore here today. The website is mythopedia.info. That's the main site you need to take a look at for much more of what we'll be discussing here today. So let's say welcome to our guest. Hi, Rens. Thank you for coming on Red Eyes Creations Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show, too. It's great. Much appreciated.
Thank you. To kind of set the context here for our program today, I'm going to read a paragraph, I thought, from that is taken from your Mythopedia website to get into the mindset, so to speak, of the program.
Excellent.
From the second half of the 20th century, cosmologists and geophysicists have made great advances in modeling the electromagnetic environment of the Earth in response to the solar wind and the other external features impinging on the Earth, such as near-Earth objects. Our purpose is to consider how knowledge of this kind might aid our understanding of traditional ideas about cosmology and the recent history of the Earth, as documented in the history of astronomy, archaeoastronomy, and certain classes of mythology and ancient ritual. Auroral phenomena and zodiacal light and various transient atmospheric events have been recorded throughout history. In particular, recent studies indicate that the Earth experienced a high-energy auroral storm towards the end of the Neolithic Age, which human cultures have recorded in the form of petroglyphs, geoglyphs, and a class of rituals and myths conveniently described as creation myths. These spectacular lively shapes caused by the instabilities in the plasma were remembered by the ancient as gods, ancestors, or dragons, whose mysterious deeds in the celestial world constituted the destruction and creation of the world. So fascinating indeed. Rens, you know, before we dive into this very interesting topic, I'd actually like to know a little bit about your background when it comes to the electric universe and of course how this connects with mythology. As I understand it, you have a master's degree in comparative and historical linguistics.
That's right, yeah, I'm actually a linguist.
Exactly, and specializing in the Indo-European and Semitic language families. So, I mean, in your studies in regards to language then, did this in any way kind of spark your interest in mythology and even perhaps in the electric universe theory?
No, actually not in the least, to be honest. It didn't spark my interest, but I do believe that linguistics is actually one of the best possible preparations for a study of mythology, and that's for two reasons. For one thing, most mythologists, people like Joseph Campbell, Mircea Eliade, the big ones, were not really able to read any of the sources they used in the original languages. But he couldn't really read Latin or Greek, and there was no analysis of Egyptian or Sumerian.
Yeah.
If you can do that, and you can check primary sources, it's just such a big advantage.
So
and the second thing is that linguistics, especially the historical branch, offers a structural method that really helps in investigating myth. Obviously, mythology as such isn't really an existing scholarly discipline with a basis of agreement among specialists. There's lots of myths are known, but the analysis, there's no single accepted theory, basically.
That's right.
I do believe in the Netherlands, for instance, it isn't even possible to study mythology as a subject.
Really?
just because it's part of the history of literature, the history of ideas. It doesn't really fit anywhere comfortably, and there's no consensus theory of myth as such.
Interesting. So, I mean, since you're specializing in Semitic language families and things like this, can you read like ancient Sumerian or Akkadian, or what are the language groups?
Sumerian, Akkadian, and a bunch of other Semitic languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, bits of Egyptian, also the classical languages, Sanskrit, Hittite, and basically the essences of most Indo-European languages. So there's bits of Old Irish, Scandinavian languages, all sorts, and a bit of Korean as well recently.
Oh, fascinating. And I guess these are kind of very good in regards to the mythology, because most of the mythologies come, you know, out from this era to begin with, isn't that right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I found the knowledge of languages as a toolkit most helpful in the investigation of myth.
Definitely.
But also the structural way of thinking, the structural methods that linguistics supplies, has been really invaluable in the study of myth as well. Basically, mythology as it came to me was just an enormous welter of unorganized data, thousands and thousands of myths, and no real method of structuring them. And linguistic models of classifying grammatical data actually helped me to devise a new method of looking at myths and sorting them and classifying them into categories and stuff.
I see.
So it's been a major advantage, this linguistic background.
Fascinating. Can you remember what kind of sparked your interest going into the area of mythology to begin with?
That started at a really early age. I remember as a child already, I was inspired and also felt a challenge to see if myths from one particular culture could be matched to those of another. Especially Greek mythology showed a number of similarities to Scandinavian myth, Germanic mythology, Iceland, the Eddas. And I was just really inspired to see if I could weave the two together into a unified narrative that would explain the two sets of them. And it didn't work, but I kept being intrigued by that throughout the years. And it wasn't until I was about 20 in my student time that I discovered that there are definitely some keys, some really fascinating keys, that help you bring myths together and find a unifying key, as it were.
Fascinating. And I guess also that this, when we tie in, or when you tie in plasma mythology or even the electric universe theories, that's maybe perhaps when you can begin to bridge the different mythologies. Would you say that that's a correct assessment to make?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fundamental. I would say the biggest common denominator in the new mythology is the influence of electromagnetic phenomena on human lives in all its manifestations. That basically you could define as what I have called plasma mythology. It's a term people have used before me. So that ranges from lightning, experiences with lightning, to auroral effects and mythology about fire. Basically everything that binds, or everything that's defined by electromagnetism, is brought together under this name. And that's a fundamentally new direction in mythology.
You said that there were some other people that have defined this term previously. Maybe you can, are there some known names, so to speak, there?
I'm not sure anything of this has appeared in printed publications so far, and the people I refer to, they are in the same group of scholars I'm working with closely. Wallace Thornhill in particular, the Australian electrical engineer who has been active in the electric universe theory,
right,
I believe was the first to throw it into the public, the term plasma mythology.
Interesting.
And I found it, for the moment being, the most comfortable term to use. Although it is a bit confusing, because we're not really talking about plasma television screens, obviously. We're also not talking about the plasma in blood.
Right.
So it isn't immediately clear to the majority of people what plasma mythology would be about. I am on the lookout for perhaps a clearer term for future use.
Maybe you could help us and define plasma a little bit then. What is the, you know, basics of it? How does it work? And can we see it somewhere today, so to speak?
Basically, plasma, I think the briefest definition would be to say that it's an ionized gas. Plasma is the fourth state of matter on top of solids and liquids and gases. And it's, in theory, it's what you get if you keep heating up a gas.
Hmm.
What happens then is that the atoms become disintegrated, electrons get loose within the gas. And as a result, you have an electric current and electromagnetic phenomena begin to develop within the gas. That's what a plasma essentially is. It's said, it's claimed by plasma physicists that 99.999% of the entire universe consists of plasma. That's a lot, so that includes all stars.
Mm.
And that includes practically everything upward from the ionosphere of the Earth and the atmosphere of the Earth. On the surface of the Earth, which we inhabit, there isn't really much plasma activity, but fire and lightning are perhaps the most familiar phenomena to us.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned Wallace Thornhill and the guys over at Thunderbolts.info. How long have you been kind of working and contributing articles to them?
I think our cooperation really goes back to 2000. But the Thunderbolts website where did these picture of the day appear, I think, has only been in the air since 2005 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Most real progress was made in the past 4 or 5 years.
All right, I see.
That also includes the work on the world axis.
Okay.
The two monographs are about that you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's definitely dive into that here a little bit later. You know, on your website also you have a very good question, I think, and I guess the answer to that is obvious to begin with, but let me read the question here. Could the prehistoric sky have been much more active than now? And again, the obvious question to that would be yes, but do you at any, you know, at this point have any ideas as to why the sky or the heavens or the space, as it were, around the Earth was more active in the past?
Yeah, before I answer that question, I should like to point out that this question, was the prehistoric sky more active than now, was also raised by astronomers who have basically nothing to do with our electromagnetic axis. Comatologists in particular in most recent years have repeatedly posed the same question just by looking at the catastrophic effects of comets, meteor showers, meteorite falls in the inner solar system. They've basically drawn the same conclusion and an increased zodiacal light that we aren't really inhabiting a very safe, stable and eventless corner of the universe. So we're sharing this with a number of other scientists at the forefront of science, I would say. So that's one thing I'd like to emphasize.
Definitely. And, you know, again, do you have any ideas to what events in the past, you know, that caused the sky at that point to be more active? Why was it more, you know, plasma basically caused back then than there is today? Or is this the case?
Okay, this is obviously the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
I don't have the answer as yet. I don't think I will ever have, for the simple reason that I am not a scientist myself. So ultimately, the answer will come from scientists, not from mythologists. But obviously, I do have an opinion, and I do believe that the likeliest scenario at this point is increased solar activity. Why am I saying that? Basically, the northern and southern lights, the auroras that you see most strongly at the poles, are directly influenced by solar weather through the so-called solar wind, which carries charged particles from the atmosphere of the sun close to our planet. And if that increases, in other words, if you have a solar storm, the effects are instantly felt on Earth as well, where you'll have increased auroral activity. Now, all you need, basically, to produce some super high-energy auroras would be just to have a massive storm taking place on the sun. And, of course, again, you could ask, why would that happen? Why would it not happen? Basically, we've been studying science proper only for a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
I think we probably haven't been long around enough to have any reasonable idea about the frequency of such potential events. So So as a working scenario, I do believe this is probably the most economic scenario we could think of. Then there's a second possibility, intruders in the solar system. What would be the effects exactly of a massive disintegrating comet arriving into the solar system, for instance? And this is basically the scenario Klub and Napier, two renowned cometologists, have been working on. And they have hypothesized that a massive comet entered into the solar system, I think about 10,000 years ago now, on the latest model.
Really?
And if that would fall apart within the inner solar system, once again, you would probably be looking at some very intense auroral effects or side effects of that, which haven't really been studied or, to satisfaction yet. So, intruders in the solar system, increased solar weather. I think those two options are the most feasible ones at present.
Okay, yeah. Okay, you mentioned 10,000 potentially BC. You know, I've been following a little bit some of these stories lately from different sources in regards to science magazines online and others, of course. But it seems to be that they recognize that there have been some kind of planetary upheaval, so to speak, in the past. Everything from, you know, large explosions in the sky, basically from a comet, as you said, or that actually, you know, a planet in some sense has actually come in and you know, wrecked another planet, and things have been happening in that regard. But so far as I understand it, they always place the timeline of these things very far back, meaning that, you know, potentially man wasn't even around at that time. So do you think that either their timeline is off, or maybe these aren't the same events that they are talking about as you are talking about here?
Yeah, chronology is obviously key to many of these questions. I think one thing we would need to get out of the way is the idea that creation myths have anything to do with the real origins of the universe. And of course, this is a figment of Western thought that we've been living with for a long time. My profound opinion at this point, based on the data I've looked at, is that creation stories as relayed by traditional human societies aren't really dealing with the actual origins of the universe, things in terms of Big Bang scenarios and the like, steady-state universe. They have nothing to do with these topics. I think what creation myth is really all about is a series of catastrophic disruptions in the recent history of the Earth. So let's say holocenic events, perhaps Pleistocenic, but within the past 10 or 15,000 years, close enough in time to us, for these societies to have remembered many details accurately, and for the fear to have survived so dramatically as we see it in ancient societies. So I think the feeling you get when looking at the rituals and the stories about creation is that there's such an intensity of experience that it's something quite recent. And if you take on board the widely spread ancient claim that history is cyclical, and that there are cosmic cycles of Earth destruction and renewal, then everything really begins to fall into place. And my guess would be, and I'm not the first person to claim this, is that the stories of creation now are about the latest in a series of catastrophic disruptions we've experienced on Earth. I think that answers the, or potentially answers much of the chronological trouble.
Right.
In that you could at the same time maintain the reality claim of creation myth, and also you would also dispense with the need for revisions of chronology. So everything would stay in place, basically. And creation, I believe, has little to do with the actual origins of the universe. I think that is a vital key.
Sure, sure, exactly. And, you know, because before you mentioned a little bit about the cycles too, and you know, in regards also to why an event would take place that causes a more active sky, so to speak. And my idea kind of went back to the Mayan calendar, actually, where they describe similar cycles, that the sun is kind of is dying and is reborn in a constant cycle, and for whatever reason, that might have a larger, astronomical background to it, why that actually happens. At this point, I guess we don't know why that would be. But do you think
that I would say the figures ancient societies have put on those cycles aren't necessarily correct. For one thing, they all contradict each other. But I think what really stands out is that most ancient societies of which we know anything have expressed belief in such systems. And they have claimed that the world is occasionally destroyed through fire, through floods, and through similar upheavals.
Yeah.
And they have detailed memories of those events. And I think that, as a mythical archetype, is just a major pointer.
Exactly.
So I'm not too sure it will be a successful venture to look at figures and try and calculate just when the previous episode was finished or when the next catastrophe will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Also because a lot of later generations of more scholarly-minded astronomers in ancient societies have labored with those figures and adjusted them. In the classical world, for example, Greek philosophers from Plato down to the Neoplatonists have offered many different figures for the length of the so-called great year, and all planets are aligned in one line. They all disagreed, and I think we just shouldn't spend too much time on the exact figures. But it's the big picture theory that really counts. And that's the one that goes back far in time.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, that we shouldn't stare ourselves blind, so to speak, on the numbers that much, but the idea of the
very earliest Egyptian texts we have already look forward to or anticipate a destruction of the world, a doomsday event, when everything will become again like it was in the days of creation, when there will be darkness again, and the god Atum will be turned into a primordial serpent again, and so on and so on. So this has been in place for at least 5,000 years.
And the question is, if they were recording like the Maya again, if we were to return to them, if they were recording these kind of cycles, that do you think that would imply in regards to their mythology that they have been around for that long, or does this imply that they themselves might have just have been calculating and trying to figure out when these cycles occur and reoccur, so to speak?
I would probably say the latter. Because I think we need to take a forensic approach to mythology. If a claim is made to antiquity, we need to look at the actual hard evidence we have in our hands. And in the majority of cases, we don't have any tangible evidence that chronological systems, calendars, were in place, let's say, at 5,000 BC or 10,000 BC. There's just some so-called oracle bones in China on which people kept the date of lunar months, but there's no real good evidence for long-term calendars from a very early time. So I would be careful with those dating systems and be inclined to believe that much of it was retrocalculated. According to the Maya system of chronology, for instance, the world was created in 3113 BC. Who knows? I think the jury is probably still out on that. People may actually have begun counting at that very date. By the same token, it's also possible that a later generation has actually back-calculated this date and set up the system from there. The same vein that the Christian calendar, for instance, was only really taken into use in the 7th century AD.
That's right, exactly. And I guess that would imply more mythology. I mean, the Maya again, if they're talking about the renewal of the sun as the kind of central point in their calendar, then this potentially could imply then that there was a very active sun not such an active sun, basically, but that this happens again in cycles and that this potentially could return at some point. Who knows, right?
And ancient societies, needless to say, did not necessarily pinpoint the sun as the cause of these effects. What we basically learn from ancient traditions is the one message we learn is that the sky was entirely different than it's now. Over and over again, we are told that at that time, the sun didn't shine yet, and there was no moon, and there were no stars. It was just darkness. And then this world column arose, The first event of creation was the formation of this gigantic sky pillar. And that actually functioned as the first light in an otherwise dark universe. And it was only after the breakup of that cosmic tree, that cosmic mountain, that the world was first lit, that the first day began and the sun and moon were put into place. So this is actually the one message you get when you look at ancient creation myths. It shouldn't be taken literally. We should just put ourselves in the position of the ancient storytellers, look through their eyes, because they are just describing what they saw on the screen of the sky, as it were, without any scientific or astronomical knowledge.
Right, right.
So when they speak about the absence of the sun and the moon in that sky, all we need to ask is, could there have been a scientific mechanism that would have made the sun and the moon invisible to see for a prolonged time?
Mm. What do you think about
would,
that?
Obviously.
Excuse me, what do you say?
That would depend on the scientific scenario you would use to explain your data. But I do believe from the literature that in the wake of a massive comet disintegration, for instance,
right.
The interior of the solar system would be dusted to such an event that the light of the sun could be blocked out effectively for a long time. There is another possibility, auroras, very intense auroras of the type we are studying in our present investigations, they may also have the capacity to blot out the light of the surrounding stars. So if you're looking at this incredibly luminous column, then it may have been so bright that the stars were far too faint to be seen, the actual stars.
Fascinating.
But this is something that would need to be studied by specialists in the field, and it's incredibly complicated, I'm told, as well. The mathematics are just complicated beyond belief, so this is not an easy question to answer.
All right. You know,
but I have obtained the impression that we can quite trust the recurrent themes in ancient traditions. We can put a great store of faith by messages such as these. The very claim that there was a time that the sun and the moon weren't seen is just one of the most common archetypes in world mythology, and I do believe we have to take it very seriously.
And what do you think what were they trying to communicate there? Do you think that this was because of this very bright light of the auroras, or do you think that this could have potentially been a large massive kind of solar system upheaval, meaning that the sun actually was kind of blotted out, that we couldn't see it?
That's actually outside my expertise, but it's important to point out that plasmas aren't always visible to the naked human eye. Plasmas come in various states depending on the intensity of the electric current that goes through them. And it's only when they enter glow mode or arc mode that they become visible to the human eye as well, so you're looking at lightnings and auroras.
Oh.
So a plasma column could in theory have existed very well without being visible to the human eye. So during the period of darkness the ancients are talking about, we could claim that there was a dusty plasma surrounding the Earth that wasn't in glow mode, that wasn't in visible mode. Whether that would also be opaque enough to block out the light of the sun and the moon, I'd love to know the answer to that question, but I don't know, and I'm hoping future research will tell. It's important to note that many of the findings of plasma physics we are using in our work are quite recent. Many of these discoveries were only made during the 90s, or even, perhaps the 80s.
Okay.
But we're really at the cutting edge of plasma science, so there's a lot of unknowns, and we're just trying to proceed as quickly as we can.
I understand. This world column that you mentioned earlier, or sky pillar, or even cosmic mountain, what do you think would have to take place in order for a thing like that to happen? What I'm asking, I guess, is what would the mechanics of that be? Do we know that today? Do you know?
Apparently, if the intensity of the electric currents coming into the ionosphere of the Earth is high enough, the auroras will collimate, and they'll actually form a column, a pillar shape. And occasionally, auroras are known to take the form of pillars. These are so-called auroral pillars. And I don't think the physics are completely understood of this, but the auroral pillars have been recorded as historical anomalies, so they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's being tested at the moment, just exactly what happens if you keep increasing the intensity of an aurora fed into by the solar wind.
Hmm.
So that's probably the physics behind the world pillar.
And
very intriguing stuff, because there are quite a few ancient traditions that speak about the sun having a tail.
Really?
Or the sun formerly having been connected with the earth by means of a rope. There's the so-called noosing of the sun myths, in which some hero or some mythical ancestor nooses the sun on a rope.
Mm.
And there's a time of eclipse and everything goes wrong. And at some point, the sun is liberated again, the rope is cut through, and the sun goes on its way again. Those stories don't come out of the blue, I believe.
I think you're totally right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you take the solar wind into account, they just begin to make so much sense. Indian mystical traditions continue to the present day to emphasize that there's a direct spiritual line between the sun and the earth. And it's like an umbilical cord as well. In the process of creation, we're told over and over again, the earth is born from the sky, and the umbilical cord is the world axis. And the moment the world axis is severed, the birthing process is complete, and the earth is really born, and we're on our own. And this is the essence of the creation of the world. It's basically the birth-giving process of the earth.
Again, I have to return to that idea of would there actually be possible, do you think, for something like that to be visible, so to speak, in regards to the Earth being connected with the sun through some kind of electrical discharge or plasma, as you said?
Well, that's actually not hypothetical. That's actually a fact. The sun is connected to the Earth right now as we speak, and the connector is called the solar wind.
Right,
and it's that steady stream, or perhaps unsteady stream, of charged particles that flow into the higher regions of the poles above the Earth.
Mm.
But most of the time, it isn't visible to us, but it's definitely been established beyond the shadow of a doubt. And the first person to hypothesize this solar wind was Christian Birkeland,
yeah,
a 19th-century Scandinavian. Was he a Norwegian? Yeah, I believe a Norwegian pioneer of plasma physics.
Yeah. Hmm.
And the canals through which the solar wind enters into the ionosphere of the Earth, in his honor, are still known as Birkeland currents.
Right.
So this is really a study of it's an area of intensive study, and this is fully agreed. The only difference is we are claiming, or perhaps I am claiming, that at some point in the past the solar wind was actually visible semi-permanently to human beings on Earth. So the plasma was actually in glow mode for a prolonged amount of time.
Hmm.
That's the only difference, but the rope is there, the connection is there.
Very interesting indeed. And I guess this also is a phenomena that potentially could have been seen, maybe not from all points of the planet, but at least, you know, a large part of the planet. Isn't that right?
That's, again, an incredibly difficult question to answer. That's one we are trying to answer through two different approaches. Within the mythical record itself, I am looking for clues of differences in perspective. There are classes of traditions about the appearance of the world axis that don't appear in some areas and do appear in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
You put all of that into a computer program, as it were, then it should be possible in the end, and it's an amazingly useful test to measure the direction at which the axis was seen to come into the Earth.
Right.
Second area, and this is probably more scientific based, is the study of the location of petroglyphs.
Right. Yeah.
This is a completely new aspect to our approach. We do believe that a large number of the so-called abstract petroglyphs, the geometric petroglyphs, record the same super auroral events. So we're looking at rock art images that belong to the late Bronze Age.
Mm-hmm.
I should say the late Stone Age and the early Bronze Age, let's say 5000 BC to 3000 BC.
Right.
And many of those shapes have never been understood, spirals and columns and concentric circles. And many of them would actually seem to fit the stories we have about the world axis. They would also seem to fit an auroral explanation, an auroral pillar, as it goes through its phases of development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the great thing about petroglyphs is they don't move around like myths.
Right.
The problem with myths is, of course, that they diffuse, so you never know for sure where a particular story was located, say 5000 BC or 1000 BC.
Yeah.
Petroglyphs don't move. So you have data, you have information about the geographic location. And that is something we've been working on for the past 5 years at least.
Really?
We've been cataloging some 20 million petroglyphs worldwide. And the results of this, the research was conducted by Dr. Perret, a plasma physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico in America.
Ah, yeah.
The initial results suggest or prove that the column was seen to come into the South Pole of the Earth, what is today the South Pole.
Really?
And we're still looking at precise angles and variations, and there also seems to have been a twist or a bend in the column close to the South Pole, which would have allowed people on the Northern Hemisphere to see it as well.
Huh. Now,
the column doesn't need to have been exactly cylindrical or perfectly cylindrical.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Ancient traditions often say it was crooked or bent, twisted. So it's a really complicated thing we're looking at.
Yeah, I definitely understand that.
I mean, petroglyphs are immensely important because they're found in situ. They have a fixed location.
Mm-hmm.
That turns, I think, this whole adventure into science. The fact that we're measuring and testing, because if we're really talking about a unified event, then the data should fit and there shouldn't be exceptions.
Hmm.
So that's an incredibly useful test we're doing.
When you're looking at petroglyphs and different images and so forth, are there something then particular that you are looking for, and are you kind of excluding some type of imagery or symbolism?
I am basically trying to establish a database of all kinds of cosmogonic traditions, cosmological traditions, and creation myths.
Mm.
So I'm just trying to be as complete as I possibly can. Obviously, I am looking for parallels and agreements, because they are the leading principles in what is universal. You always need to apply some sort of filter, obviously, when looking at large amounts of data.
Mm.
So you do need to look for correspondences, and they lead the way. At the same time, it's very important to keep the anomalies in mind as well. There's always a large amount of data that don't fit, and I have learned that just by taking those exceptions seriously and not just shove them under the carpet, that you actually learn quite a lot.
Yeah.
Once you just categorize the anomalies in themselves, you begin to see new patterns, and often something completely new comes out of that.
Hmm.
So this is definitely ongoing research, and it's all about finding the right balance between the agreements we think are universal and the things we are exceptional.
Mm.
Think are exceptional.
Mm. Hmm. Absolutely.
So yes, you can't say that all data fit. There are plenty of exceptions. There is plenty in mythology that doesn't fit. That's going to happen with every theory. But I do believe that if you look at the mythology of the world axis and creation mythology as a whole, that there is a narrative that is at the heart of mythology worldwide, really at the heart. If you look at previous theories of myth, let's say the psychological approach taken by Jung, or the fertility theory of James Frazer, you will have the impression that the examples they choose are far more selective and far less representative of mythology as a whole.
Hmm.
I think we've definitely hit the core of what mythology is about.
Right. And this is...
I would say two things emerge from a study of ancient myth.
Mm.
The first thing is that the events take place in the sky, and the second thing is that the events are unusual. They're not talking about the rising of the sun, or the myths didn't start as metaphors for mundane events.
Mm-hmm.
They're about extraordinary, shocking, and traumatizing events.
Exactly.
They're about things in the sky, not about mushrooms growing in a field. So if you just take those two keys, then almost all earlier theories of myth fall out.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, you recently had an article up there on thunderbolts.info called Peopling the Mythical Landscape, basically about the creation of the world and of man. And tell us a little bit, if you will, about this kind of concept or idea that so many, also, you know, again, different cultures from around the world seem to have the same basic theme going, you know.
Yeah, and obviously the themes themselves are unbelievable. That's the intriguing thing about this. The agreements we find in ancient myths are not obvious or predictable. One thing you will hear wherever you travel is, yeah, there used to be this gigantic rope that connected the earth with the sky, and the people used to travel up and down on that cable, and we used to be in touch with the gods, but then something really horrible happened, and the rope was severed at some point, and now we're left alone. And the sky has retreated. It's much further now than it used to be. It all sounds like complete and utter madness from a modern perspective. But you keep hearing the same story over and over again. I've collected hundreds of examples from all five continents of this, four continents. So there's definitely a message there. The anomalies, again, are leading the way. What are these people talking about? Either they're complete fruitcakes, or there is definitely something going on in the history of the planet that we've missed so far.
Yeah. So, I mean, this idea of let's talk about the creation of man itself. I mean, there seems to be a weird kind of idea there in the mythology that people were around, so to speak, at the time when man was created. So the question that arises there is, how can there be an observer of an event like that?
The people are the ancestors of the people are always presented as eyewitnesses to creation.
Yeah, exactly.
Very odd in itself. This is, of course, a problem that Christian interpreters and Jewish ones have also been struggling with since antiquity. Right. The question that, according to the book of Genesis in the Bible, apparently the author knew what happened in the 5 days before Adam was created.
Yeah.
How would he have known? Yeah. The standard Protestant answer has been he was revealed the information by God directly in a vision.
Yeah.
Well, who knows, but it does sound like an ad hoc solution.
Yep.
And I think the only real answer is to put it into a comparative context. The same conundrum arises in many different cultures, in many different myths. So there really is a paradox when you're looking at ancient traditions. And the paradox is, on one hand, we're told that people were witnessing creation, or this is implicit in the stories.
Mm.
On the other hand, we're also told how the first ancestor was created. I've collected quite a few examples in which the first ancestor was created, but people had already been in existence much earlier, before his creation.
Exactly.
Flagrant contradictions, but they are in the text. One answer is that people aren't always people in ancient traditions. I'd say every anthropologist knows that in societies across the Americas, Africa, traditional societies, that ancestors were often seen as animals or other nature objects, and these are called totem societies.
Right.
And no firm lines were drawn between humans and other living species. So it's actually quite likely that when the mythical sources we have speak about the people in a particular time, that they are really some other animated-looking or living objects that seem to be alive in the sky, actually. They're moving up and down along the world axis. And often they're fully interchangeable with the animals. In North American mythology, for instance, in one sentence you'll hear that the people went up and down the rope of heaven, and the next sentence they'll say the animals this and the birds that. Fully interchangeable. So we should be very careful that we look through the spectacles of ancient society, through the lenses of the ancient way of thinking,
right,
which wasn't even necessarily the same in every society, of course.
Yeah.
So you do need something like a proper methodology, a proper approach to the study of ancient myth.
are...
It's dangerous just to look at the surface level and just take things literally. I think that would lead you astray.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. So, I mean, in some sense also, what I kind of pick up on here when you're mentioning these things is that these are all also kind of archetypal images, meaning that either if we talk about gods or different animals or different, properties, so to speak, of something or of human beings or something like that, would you agree that this you know, these kind of archetypal images then might have come from these plasma events that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question. If only because the term archetypes usually conjures up a completely different idea of where myths come from. Obviously, archetypes are the basic patterns of myth that Jung believed spring from our collective unconscious.
Right.
And this theory, I think, has now mostly been abandoned by scholars of myth, but it's still very much alive in popular awareness. So what are archetypes? Do we mean Jungian archetypes, or do we mean archetypes in the sense of recurring basic mythical patterns?
Mm-hmm.
I would argue with Jung in the sense that I do not believe that these recurrent patterns, the archetypes, originate in the human brain solely. I think that it's just a failure. This is basically a shortcoming in the Jungian theory. The idea that psychological structures originate mythical archetypes, let's say the Ouroboros, the round serpent,
right,
the serpent of creation,
mm-hmm,
I think makes a mockery of the worldwide belief that creation myths, or that creation really happened.
Mm.
Wherever you would travel as an anthropologist and whichever tribe you would interview, you would always be guaranteed that the things had exactly happened the way they told.
Mm.
And it's not for nothing that human sacrifices were made in so many societies and other sacrifices and festivals were held in to celebrate creation. Creation is something that was taken incredibly seriously worldwide, wherever you look, all ancient societies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's serious business. It's a business that costs lives. And it's definitely something that really, really transpired a long time ago. So if you look at these armchair theories, basically, of people like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, they aren't taking this aspect of the myth seriously. Although, of course, I hasten to add that Jung has been an incredibly erudite scholar, and I much admire his work. It's an absolute goldmine.
Right, right.
But I do believe he has missed some of the two fundamentals of myth I just mentioned. Creation happens in the sky, for one thing, and it's about unusual events, for a second. Those two key factors were overlooked in the original theory of Jung's archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
I would basically contend that the origin of the mythical archetypes is external to the human mind, not internal.
But when they are an external image, or because of an event, or that the event itself actually is very traumatic, then that could kind of initiate or begin to spark something at first the individual minds, but later on that might be actually a kind of a collective memory. I don't know if you have any ideas about that at all.
Yeah, that's again a difficult question, because the key, of course, is whether the collective unconscious is something real or not.
Right, right.
As far as I know, the existence of the collective unconscious has never been confirmed. So that's a major hypothesis in itself. It's a question mark. So perhaps there is some sort of elusive mechanism by which such traumatic impressions can be stored, as mm-hmm, it were, in a collective human awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's all just much simpler, and perhaps it's just culture itself that suffices to convey the images from generation to generation.
Right.
My personal impression is I like Occam's razor. We need to work with minimal sets of explanations. For all the data I've seen personally, it's enough to just assume that society itself, culture itself, carries the symbols forward.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually looked at some of Jung's books that he wrote about the subject of the archetypes. And the people who had those spontaneous dreams in which the archetypes occurred, I wouldn't say those people were completely unimpressed or did have spontaneous experiences. It turns out that many of those patients had been deeply interested in esoteric traditions, had read a lot of myth. So, to me, the most economic solution would be that they had known and read enough about myth and then began to dream about it.
Right.
I mean, we do need to be serious about about these matters, and we do need to look for the most economic explanations. And to me, the collective unconscious just sounds a bit too mysterious.
Mm.
Something like this may well exist, but the evidence is still forthcoming, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, this is something in the progress. I guess I take the approach that just because we haven't been able to prove it doesn't mean that we have to exclude it, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But extraordinary theories require extraordinary evidence.
Well, exactly. That's right.
And,
exactly.
It may sound funny, since the theories we are talking about are quite extraordinary in themselves.
Well, exactly. I mean, that was one.
I'd like to point out that we do have the extraordinary evidence, and it takes a decade to or much longer to produce that and process that. But the evidence is definitely in.
Well, exactly. And I mean, to some regard, if I mean, I guess that some scientists have used the Occam's razor idea, and actually because of that and because of their own mindset, they have excluded a theory that you're now presenting, basically.
I wouldn't blame any earlier generations of thinkers for not having considered electromagnetism for one simple reason. Much of what we now know about the auroras and about the environment of the Earth wasn't known about 20 or 30 years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's only since these insights in plasma science are so recent, it's only natural that the first people to think of human consequences of these events have also appeared quite recently.
Hmm.
In 1960, no one could have said there have been super auroras. Well, they could have, but they wouldn't have much ground to stand on. And what we know now of the behavior of auroras and the way we can currently model what would happen if auroras intensify, simply unavailable before 1990 or 1980. So everything has its own time, and I think the time is now ripe for plasma mythology, or perhaps a better term.
Absolutely, and that's why we're so so interesting to have you on the program and to talk about this, because I think it's a fascinating idea. And Rens, I think that this is a great place to actually take a little break right here, and then we're going to continue our discussion in our member section and dive further into some of the topics that we haven't kind of dived into yet. I want to talk a little bit more about the idea of the Ouroboros, the dragon, where the mythology of the reptile or the dragon comes from.
Right.
Also a little bit about Velikovsky, perhaps, if you have any ideas and theories about him and so forth. So there's much more here to dive into. But before we finish off here this segment, you have two books out there, The Mythology of the World Axis, Exploring the Role of Plasma in World Mythology, and also the other one is The World Axis as an Atmospheric Phenomena. People that are interested in getting a copy of your book, are they available on your website?
Yeah, the books can be ordered through my website or also directly at the website of the printer.
Excellent.
The printer is www.lulu.com.
Right.
It's lulu.com. And if you just enter my name in the search bar, then you'll see the two books and you can order them from there directly.
Excellent. And again, I want to mention the website before we finish off. Mythopedia.info, that's the main website you need to take a look
Maybe
at.
Maybe the easiest way to do it, yeah.
Right, exactly. Okay, so let's take a short break right here and we'll continue and talk more on the other side of the break. So thank you for coming on, Rens.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.